go. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, February 8, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Representative Guerra, Co-Chair Representative Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg, and Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Foster. Representatives Ortiz and Pruitt have been previously excused from today's meeting. Did I say Guttenberg?
There he is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was forecasting. I knew I could feel Representative Guttenberg's presence. Representative Guttenberg is here. The force is strong here in finance today. Before we start, just a reminder.
We were looking for.
If folks could please mute their cell phones. And at this meeting, we will have second hearings on two bills, HB 142, which is the Unemployment Compensation Benefits Bill, and that is by Representative Tuck. And then also HB 213, it's a bill relating to the Public School Trust Fund, and that is by Representative Parrish. And if it is the will of the committee, it is my intent to move both of the bills today. So with that, we will start off with HB 142. And let's see, we last heard this bill on February 2nd. We heard public testimony, and there is one amendment on this bill today. So I would like to ask, I believe Representative Tuck can't be here at the moment, but his staff, Ms. Kendra Kloster, is here. If she could come to the table, as well as Patty Westcott, the Assistant Director for Employment Security at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And if you could both put yourselves on the record. Is there anything that you would like to add, or are you here for questions? Just questions.
Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Tuck. He apologizes he cannot be here. He's chairing committee right now. And we're just here for additional questions from the committee.
So before we move on to the amendment, are there any questions, Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had I have a couple. So I understand that we're changing the amounts so that we're closer to the 50% percentile. But my curiosity is, why did we stop at 59,500? Why would we not make a scale all the way up?
For the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm Assistant Director with the Division of Employment and Training Services at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We stopped at that amount because the way the schedule currently is, it adds $2. It increases the benefit amount in $2 increments, and the qualifying base period wages in $250 increments. And so we kept going on that scale until we reached the amount of 510, which is approximately 50% of the state's average weekly wage.
Oh, okay. Another follow-up?
Follow-up.
And on the fiscal note, I just kind of want to make sure that I have it right. So, and I know this is just it's on the one that's indeterminate, but it has an estimate that if this was done in 2017, that there would have been a difference of the cost of $456,600. Now, would I take 72% of that $456,600? That would be the state's share of increase if this bill were to pass?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that fiscal note was prepared by OMB. I'm not sure that I am the most appropriate person to speak to the estimates in that fiscal note.
Okay, so is there somebody from the department here?
Yes, there is.
And
I can bring Caroline up and she can help explain the OMB fiscal note.
If you could put your name and your title on the record.
For the record, my name is Caroline Schultz and I'm a policy analyst at the Office of Management and Budget.
Thank you. Can you repeat the question?
Let me just make sure your question is, you want to know the state share of that?
So it's an indeterminate fiscal note because we don't know what the wages will be or who will literally qualify in each area. So it's just an estimate. All I'm trying to make sure is that it says that if this was done in 2017, based on the 1,515 former employees, that there would have been a cost difference of $456,600. But my understanding is that the employee pays for part of it, the employer pays for part. And since this is based on the state, I'm just trying to see whether, basically, would we only be paying $328,000 on this, because that would be 72% of the 456.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I understand your question now. The state pays the actually, let me take a step back. So the way that we pay for state employee unemployment insurance claims is every state employee, there's a rate that's associated with every employee, and it's 0.4% for unemployment insurance, and that 0.4% goes into the working reserve account. And that's this fund that we pay out. We pay out terminal leave cash-ins from there. We pay out unemployment insurance claims from that fund. So that fund is funded by that 0.4%. The 0.4% just comes from personal services. As I'm sure the committee knows, about 50% of personal services costs is GF, 36% is DGF and other, and 14% is Fed. So of that 456.6 thousand, about 228,000 is UGF, 164,000 is DGF and other, and 64,000 is Fed.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, the percentage is down still.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Wilson. So, okay, so the 50% UGF would be 228.3 thousand. And then we have 36% is DGF and other, and that's about 164,000. And then the remaining 14% federal funds is 64,000.
I appreciate that, because we have an indeterminate one. It makes it kind of difficult when we're trying to figure out where it's supposed to go. So that was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It's more for my clarification, and I'm going through the paperwork to see it, and I can't, and I apologize. When was the last time the weekly benefit amount was increased?
Through the chair, Representative Grin, the last time the weekly benefit amount was increased was effective January
1st, 2009. And then
follow up, Representative Grin, and just a reminder, if each of the, since we have three female voices, if we could just identify ourselves for the record. Thank you, Representative Grin.
Thank you. This would be automatic adjustments, correct, every year?
Through the chair, Representative Grin, this is Patsy Westcott for clarification with the division. The second part of the bill does allow or contain language to allow for automatic increases moving forward.
Representative Grin?
In the notes we have, it says, this was last year anyways, 36 states have automatic adjustments. That would be similar to ours. Has that number changed since the last presentation last year?
This is Patsy Westcott. Through the chair, Representative Grin, no, the number is still 36.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Representative Guerra?
Mr. Chair, I could see how this is an indeterminate fiscal note, and I guess I'm comfortable leaving it that way. The only problem is at the end of the year, there's no budget money put in for what we know will be roughly $228,000 of general funds. So I think the committee needs to remember that as we move forward, that there's probably going to be a $230,000 cost. If folks are comfortable with the indeterminate fiscal note, I am too, but I'll go with the will of the committee on that.
Do we have any further questions or comments? Seeing none, I will move over to the one amendment that we have before us. Amendment number one was brought to the committee by the sponsor, and it updates the effective date from 2018 to 2019. And this can be found on page 9, line 28 of the bill. And the amendment also extends the date on page 9, line 13, to December 31, 2020, from December 31, 2019, to keep with the original intent of the bill. So are there any questions of the committee for the sponsor of the bill regarding this amendment? And one moment here, if we could, before we have discussion, need to move the amendment. So I move the amendment, and is there any objection? Okay, seeing no objection, amendment number one to bill before us 30-LS0530/U.1 is adopted, and we'll move over to the fiscal. Representative Seaton, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm uncomfortable with the indeterminate fiscal note. The fiscal note has a purpose.
Microphone.
Mic. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm don't know quite how to address it right now. I'm uncomfortable with an indeterminate fiscal note because the fiscal notes are combined into the budget to give us a they are combined in the appropriations. If we don't have an amount to combine in the appropriation, it means no money is going to be appropriated for this bill if it passes. So, Mr. Chairman, I hadn't really gone through or thought about this before, exactly how to handle it. So, I just want to put this statement on the record right now, and I might want to take it at ease while I figure out how to handle that more appropriately.
And maybe what we can do is let's go ahead and have Vice Chair Guerra read the fiscal note into the record, and then we will take in at ease look at what some of the options might be. So with that, Vice Chair Guerra, if you could read the fiscal note into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 142, version U, has two fiscal notes. First, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Labor, appropriation employment and training services, allocation unemployment insurance, OMB component 2276. And the second is the indeterminate fiscal note we just talked about from OMB that reaches across all departments in the state, OMB component number zero.
Okay. Are there any further questions? I guess maybe we should give some folks some time. I don't know if Ledge Finance might have anything to say. If not, we can just let folks kind of have some time to talk it over a little bit. So I don't see any hands raising or anything. So let's – would you like to come to the table and maybe address that, and then we'll take a brief at ease? And if you could just put yourself on the record.
I'm Kelly Cunningham with Legislative Finance. Through the chair, because raising the increase in the UI benefits would touch all allocations, I don't think there's any way to do a fiscal note that would represent every allocation in the state. So we worked with OMB and the department on this, and it made sense to do the various fiscal note indeterminate as long, they put the amount anticipated on the analysis. So I don't know. I can't foresee another option, really.
Thank you. Do we have any questions, Representative Guerra, and then Guttenberg?
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. So would the normal course then be to, when the budget is reconciled at the end of the year, add these funds as a statewide appropriation? Are people going to see a zero fiscal note, and are we going to have to fire two arbitrary employees somewhere who aren't arbitrary to fund something that costs $200,000?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there would not be an appropriation in the operating bill, and these costs would be rolled into the annual salary runs with all the other benefits that go into the salary adjustment. So you really won't see them. If it ends up being $230,000, that will just be rolled in, spread throughout all the agencies and rolled into the increases next year.
Through the chair.
Follow up?
I'm fine with the bill, right? It's and in the world of things, $200,000 is, the bank was broken years ago. So I'm fine with the bill. I'm going to vote for the bill. I just I don't want to see us possibly lose two employees because we didn't put a fiscal note in here. Two employees that we haven't even identified.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I it wouldn't be two employees in the Department of Labor because the $200,000 would be spread throughout the state agencies. So
we don't know which two it would be.
Maybe 0.1 from one. No.
Ms. Cunningham, can you just briefly summarize what you said at the beginning? I know that Representative Seat was also looking at some other options, and I just wanted him to hear what you had said about that.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I was explaining that because the increase in the UI, the unemployment insurance benefits, would touch all allocations throughout the state, there really wouldn't be a very efficient way to do a fiscal note for that, you know, so the various note made sense to have the indeterminate as long as the estimated amount was in the analysis.
Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Chairman, so will this not actually go into effect until our next fiscal year? So it would not impact the budget that we're currently doing, or will it impact the budget that we're currently reviewing if this bill were to pass?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe it would go into effect January 1st of 19, so it would impact one half of the FY19 budget that we're looking at. So I guess you could take half of the 230, and it would be 115 in 19. And perhaps 230 and 20 going forward, but it would be automatic.
Thank you.
Do you have any further questions of the, was that Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want that same clarity that the indeterminate fiscal note doesn't end up as a negative in the budget. It just gets, because we don't know what that cost is, that goes from conference committee to actuals to governor, is it added in because it's an interim when we know what the actual is, or does it, in order to make it whole next year down the road, would we need to add something, or is it just automatically added because it's an indeterminate?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I think I'm going to defer to Caroline on this one. My understanding is these get rolled in after the fact and charged after the fact, but I'm gonna.
If I may, so your point was it gets added after the fact and not subtracted after the fact.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? Okay, seeing no further questions, we just read the fiscal note into the record. Did we still want to take an ID so that folks could kind of think about this more? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I checked in that we can, if we decide we need to do a fiscal note during conference committee at that time. So I'm comfortable moving the bill.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 142, version 30LS0530/U for uniform from House Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 142, version 30-LS0530/U, as amended, is reported out from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. And with that, if we will take a quick at ease and have folks sign the report. Okay, House Finance is back on record at 1:56 p.m., and our next bill up today is HB 213. It's a bill relating to the Public School Trust Fund by Representative Parrish. We last heard this bill on January 30th, where we adopted a committee substitute, which is version R, and we took public testimony. My office did receive one amendment on HB 213, and so I would like to ask the sponsor, Representative Parrish, and his aide, Ms. Lisa Worrell, to please come to the table and put yourselves on the record, and if there is anything that you would like to add, please do so. We'll open it up to committee questions, and we do have a number of other people who are available for questions, so first we'll let you put yourself on the record and if there's anything you'd like to add.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Representative Justin Parrish for District 34.
Lisa Worrell, staff to Rep. Parrish.
I think I made the pitch last time. This is a way that we can bring in additional revenue for the state of Alaska, partially through better management of one of our large investment funds. We can continue to achieve the mission of the trust to maintain its inflation-adjusted value, and we can do better at spinning off money to support public education. I have no fundamental objections to the amendment offered. Of course, I like my version, but the amendment is also perfectly sensible, and I've no profound objection, and I believe it would likely enjoy the support of the deputy commissioner, although I should not speak on his behalf. So we'll leave that until it comes up.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Are there any questions of the committee for the sponsor? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to let you know right off, I've been trying to understand this bill and what the problem was, so I'm going to try to get my questions on the record to make sure that I've got it correct. So help me understand how much money we were making off of this account, the way it was being managed, and how much we would possibly make if we changed the management to what we have here.
Certainly. Now, if you'll look forward, there's a form which we've submitted to the committee. And I might ask Deputy Commissioner Barnhill to join us, as he's got a deeper knowledge of the subject. But if you go down to the, third line and fourth line below the table in notes, the status quo, it earns a little bit less. Where did we go? Here we are. So endowment returns have been a little bit under 6%, about a fifth of a percent under 6%, or that's the projection. Yeah. I'll hand it off to the deputy commissioner.
Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, deputy commissioner. So I sent a letter dated last Saturday, which should be in the bill packet, and attached to that letter are the returns of the public school trust, and I'd be happy to go over those with you now to give you the historical sense of what this fund has done. So these are December 31st, 2017 returns. The one-year return is 13.79%, 3 years 6.74%, 5 years 7.36%, and 10 years 6.23%. To provide, through the chair, Representative Wilson, a bit more background on what this bill does. The primary intent from our perspective is not necessarily to generate more income for public schools. It's to convert this trust fund from an old-style principal and income trust fund to a modern-style endowment fund. And when we do that, the purpose changes, it adjusts, it evolves from protecting principal to protecting the inflation-adjusted value of the fund over time. The old-style principal and income fund can do a fine job protecting the inflation-adjusted value. The endowment approach does that a bit more precisely. So once we do that, and we convert it to an endowment-style trust fund, then the Department of Revenue feels comfortable in changing the asset allocation. So currently, we have roughly 55% invested in equities, 45% invested in fixed income. Because it's under a principal and income style of accounting, we've weighted it more heavily to fixed income so it will generate cash. And under the statute that governs this trust fund, only cash can be expended. Once we convert it to an endowment fund, then we'll weight it more heavily to equities, something akin to a 70% weight to equities, 30% to fixed income. It can be then invested a bit more aggressively, and over time the expectation is that we'll generate more income. Endowment, there's twofold principles. One is we want to protect the inflation-adjusted value over time so that the real value of the fund doesn't change. And at the same time, we want to maximize in a prudent way income to current beneficiaries. In so doing, you manage essentially the fairness of the trust so that it's providing the same benefit over various periods of time. There's intergenerational equity is the way we refer to it. I don't know if that helps.
Follow up?
And it does help. My biggest concern is the idea that we could get into the principal of it. I understand that there's no rules anymore. There used to be rules that you couldn't get into the principal, and federal government, I guess, decided they were fine with that, but, you know, look how they do their budget, so that doesn't make me feel very good. So I'm trying to figure out why the so that's all based on the 4.75 of the POMV, and I'm fine with the percent of market value. But why would we do 4.75 if there is a chance of getting into the principal versus, like, maybe a 4 or 4.25 that would lessen those chances?
Through the chair, it might help actually to just kind of step through the amendment, and I can get exactly to your question so that the committee understands exactly what the amendment does. So the guts of the amendment are really on page 2.
Mr. Chair, would you like to move the amendment?
I'd like to get the explanation.
Okay.
Please proceed.
So on the amendment, page 2, lines 7 and 8, inserts the words not more than before 4.75. So right now the bill reads 4.75 can be appropriated of the 5-year average market value of the fund. By inserting the words not more than, that gives us the ability to course correct. So there may be investment environments, economic environments, in which we, in an effort to both maintain inflation-adjusted value while maximizing income to current beneficiaries, we want to appropriate less than 4.75% so that we can course correct if we're not getting that value to remain at roughly inflation-adjusted value. We could in 1 year appropriate or recommend for appropriation, the legislature does the appropriation, 4.5%. Again, from a investment management perspective, what we're trying to do is maintain the inflation-adjusted value over, you know, successive periods of time. The other part of the amendment on page 2, lines 10 to 12, simply eliminates the distinction between principal and income. And through the chair, Representative Wilson, your concern is a fair one. In every transition from a principal and income trust to an endowment trust, the question is always raised, are we going to be able to protect principal? Are we going to invade principal and spend principal in a down market at a time when the trust is what we call underwater? And what modern trust law has permitted trustees of endowments to do is, in fact, to spend when the endowment is underwater. And the notion is, again, we're trying to balance competing concerns, protecting the inflation-adjusted value over periods of time, but also meeting the needs of current beneficiaries. In substantial down markets, modern trust law permits the expenditure from an underwater trust. But the expectation is that the management of that going forward will do everything it can to return the value to the inflation-adjusted value, and that's why we put the course correction that not more than 4.75%. So we as trust administrators can make the recommendation, hey, we're underwater by X amount this year. We recommend that you appropriate something less than 4.75%. The nice thing about having the not more language is that that analysis would be made annually. And so we would continue to course correct within an effort to achieve those twofold goals, to maintain the value and to meet current needs.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson?
So, and I appreciate that. I truly do. And I guess I still am, I know the 4.75 seems to be kind of the amount used in endowments, not necessarily what the market has done with this particular account, but what's, I guess what's general practice that's out there. Have they ever made it to where it would say, you know, not more than 4.75, but not to go into the principal? Is that, would that hurt this bill to do that? Or, because I understand that we appropriate, that's where the problem is. If you guys did it and just told us that this is what you get, I probably wouldn't have as much heartburn, but it comes back here and you never know what that's going to happen. And back to, we want to make sure that this fund stays as healthy or healthier than it is right now.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Again, completely fair question, and we've called this the blow-through concern. Will we make a recommendation? Will the legislature blow through it? Or in during the budget development process, will we go the distance to the 4.75? And truly, I can't offer you any guarantee that that won't happen. But my hope is that once we adopt this, that let me back up and say this falls under a new concept in trust law called the prudent expenditure rule. Previously, you've heard of the prudent investment rule, and what the experts in trust law, the law professors and whatnot, have done is they've married up a prudent expenditure rule to sit right next to the prudent investment rule. And the idea is that you are subjecting the expenditure or the recommendation in this case for expenditure to a prudency evaluation, and also I believe subjecting it to the fiduciary standard of care, which is the highest standard under law. So our hope is that if the legislature embraces this approach, which has really become standard in trust endowment management throughout the country, that when we the administrators make a recommendation to spend less than 4.75%, and we provide analysis justifying that, that the legislature will respect that. And we would come back and explain all the reasons and the factors that we evaluated to support spending less. And I guess we would just have to see. But again, I would say that when this kind of analysis is done pursuant to a fiduciary standard of care, I think you can pretty much count on that we're going to do a fairly rigorous analysis and give you our best guess as to what is the prudent way to expend from the trust.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Guttenberg. We probably should put this amendment before us for discussion. So, Representative Guerra, can we have a motion?
Yeah, I move amendment number one.
Object.
And we have an objection, and is there anything else that you'd like to, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, both Representative Pruitt and I had expressed concerns and thought an amendment was needed to this bill. I can't speak for Representative Pruitt, who's not here, that this is the exact one he wanted. We were actually talking about a different one at the time. But without this amendment, you would have a situation where in a very bad stock market, instead of spinning off $25 million a year like this trust fund does, you would actually have to spin off no dollars that year and come up with the $25 million somewhere else. And then the next year, if it was another down year, sometimes you have two bad down years in a row, again, no money. And the prudent expenditure rule says we manage trust for the long term to maintain the principles over the long term. Not exactly for every single year, but over the long term. So the principal is fully maintained over the long term. If you were a pensioner and you were living off your trust fund, and you were relying on the money, and the stock market went down 1 year, and your trustee told you you can't have any money, you wouldn't be able to pay for anything, right? And that's the point of the public school trust fund, is we want to spin off a consistent amount of money in a careful way. So that is why we sort of follow the modern trust rule, which is in an odd year, yeah, you can go into principal. You don't have to. And that's why the bill says the trustees get to determine how much to spin off. It would be up to 4.75%, not 4.75%. If they felt like that was too aggressive in a certain market condition, they would, Mr. Barnhill will explain if I'm wrong, but they would probably do something a little different. The other thing, and the need for this bill that Representative Pruitt and I did identify was the way the bill is written right now, if you look at your chart, the bill, based on a five-year look back, you're trying to balance generating income while protecting the principal. And under the five-year look back that's in this bill, after 10 years, the projection is that about 2.5% of the principal would disappear. The sponsor of the bill originally went with a 10-year look back, and that, I think in the sponsor's view, limited the revenue too much. And so what this does is spins off roughly $8 million more a year in revenue than the way the current bill works, which I think is the sponsor's intent, and also lets the fund invest as they believe is prudently rather than more conservatively than they'd want to generate better returns over the long term. So that's the purpose of the amendment. You know, I'm not going to fall on my sword over this, but I think it's a safe way to produce more revenue out of the trust fund, which is the sponsor's intent, and is intended to make sure that we protect the principal over the long term. And if I have any of that wrong, Mr. Barnhill, if the amendment is written wrong in any way, please let us know. I think we probably have Kate Glover on the phone. We had you and Ms. Glover, I think, work on the amendment together. So,
Mr. Barnhill, do you have any comments?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the amendment is fine, and yes, we did work on it together. The only comment that I would add is we're looking at this chart that we distributed that has the various averaging methodologies. You will see that over a with the five-year averaging POMV, the inflation-adjusted value at the end of that 10-year period is less than 100%. And at the end of a 20-year period, it's still less than 100%, but it's incrementally better. With the not more than insertion from the amendment, it would be our job to do better than this and to course correct periodically so that we're staying closer to 100%. Though I will say that, you know, over long periods of time, if you're hitting close to, you know, 97 to 100%, you're doing a pretty good job.
Great. Do we have any questions of the committee? Representative Wilson?
Yes. Can somebody explain Section 1? Because it's a complete change to what we have, and I do not understand it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So you're talking about the first part of the amendment? Okay, so the first part of the amendment, page 1, lines 1 through 19, I believe, are simply conforming. You can see that the deleted language includes reference to 3714.110C as well as 3714.160. The 3714.160 is inserted right next to it. So all we're doing is conforming it to the amendment. As I said at the outset, the last section of this amendment deletes 110C, which is what creates the distinction between principal and income in this particular trust. So we're deleting the distinction between principal and income, or the requirement to account for it. And so this amendment right here just simply takes 110C out of the statute.
Follow up,
and then Representative Gurr.
Okay, so it looks like you have the Commissioner of Revenue is making a determination. That's being taken out because it says delete lines 4 through 10. So since the Commissioner is not doing it, now obviously someone else is making the determination of – I honestly have no idea what you just said.
Okay.
weren't talking about.
I just know the commissioner was taken out of it because that was what Section 1 was.
Okay, let me just pause a sec and let me catch up here.
I'm sorry.
If you'll look to page 2.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you'll look to page 2, lines 9 and 10, you'll see that amongst the duties of the commissioner, there is to determine on July 1st of each year the average monthly average market value of the fund for the five fiscal years preceding the previous year. So there is still a calculation taking place.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I caught up. I apologize. So the repeal of Section 110C takes place in two parts of the amendment. It's the deletion of all material, lines 4 to 10. Okay, we're not going to amend that anymore. We're just going to repeal it. And the repealer is the last part of the amendment. In lieu of what we now have as Section 1, there's a new Section 1, which is simply conforming.
Conforming to what? I'm sorry, conforming to what? I mean, I don't understand
it's,
what
it's just deleting the reference to 3714.110C, which we're repealing.
I just don't get it. I don't know what I'm missing. But I understand that we're deleting lines 4 through 10. Okay. But in Section 1... Now, on the amendment, correct? Now we're talking about AS 371007, and we're amending that part in the amendment, correct?
Very quickly, I think Representative
Garrett, we're adding D.
Might have an answer also, a different perspective
sure.
on that.
Yeah. So I hope this makes it easier. I think everybody understands we're taking out Section 1 in this amendment. That's 3714110C. So if you look on line 7 of the amendment, 3714110C is taken out. For some reason, they also take out 3714160, but then they put 3714160 back in the bold. So it probably could have been written differently, but the 160 was already in there, and it stays in there. The only thing being taken out is the part that's deleted, 110C.
It's just conforming. Sorry.
Follow-up.
Follow-up.
I wish you quit using that word because I don't know what he's conforming to.
I'll stop.
I'm sorry. But it says, okay, so it says, in exercising investment custodial or depository powers or duties under this section, the fiduciary or fiduciary's designee is liable for a breach of a duty that is assigned or delegated under this section. However, the fiduciary or the designee is not liable for a breach of a duty that has been delegated to another person if the delegation is prudent under the applicable standard of prudence set out in statute or if the duty is assigned by law to another person except to the extent that the fiduciary or designee. So this has got to be a person, I'm assuming, and it's not the commissioner because we took that out. So is that the trustees that we're talking about? That's now, I'm just trying to figure out who we're talking about because it's not in English.
Representative Gura?
Every single word in the amendment from line 4 through line 19 is already in the law right now. The only change is the deletion of 3714110C, which is the issue of whether or not you're ever allowed to dip into the principal. So that is all that has changed in the law that's on the books right now, is that one statutory reference.
So follow-up?
Follow-up.
So, Representative, if we kept in that portion of it, then that would prevent the principal from being touched?
If 3714 through the chair. If 3714110C were left in, then you would leave the system the way it is right now, which is it would be a principal trust instead of a prudent expenditure rule trust.
Follow up,
Representative Wilson.
Which is not necessarily what I want to do. I'm just concerned about the principal itself, not necessarily keeping it within where it's at. So I am fine with the changes, and I'm glad it says up to. But I just don't trust us that we would not necessarily not still utilize the 4.75 because we don't know what the times will be. And it doesn't take me time to go into the principal to where we could actually – and I've seen that. We've done it into the higher education fund. We've done a little bit to power cost equalization. We haven't, I don't think, gone into it as much as we have the higher education. And, you know, I just want to make sure that we're protecting what was put there for the students. I think it's great that we're going to increase how much money we're going to make and be able to utilize that in education. I just can't get over the part that we would have the possibility, even with recommendation of the department, to say, well, you know, that's nice, but we want to take all the money. But thank you. I do at least understand the other part of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Do we have any further questions on the amendments? Seeing no further questions, Representative Wilson, do you maintain your objection?
No, I remove my objection.
Your objection has been removed. Any further objections? Seeing no further objections, Amendment number 130-LS0765-R.6 has been adopted, and we'll move over to the fiscal notes. Representative Guerra, if you could read those into the record for HB 213.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we have, let me just make sure I have the numbers right. We have three fiscal notes on this bill. One is OMB component 2804, Department Fund Capitalization, Appropriation Fund Capitalization, Allocation Public Education Fund. That is a zero fiscal note. The second fiscal note that we have is OMB component 1060, Department of Education and Early Development, Mount Edgecombe Boarding School, Allocation Mount Edgecombe Boarding School. There is a $4.6 million operating expenditure fiscal note that is included in the governor's budget request. I don't think that's particularly called for in this bill, but is the governor's budget request. And OMB component 141, Department of Education and Early Development, K through 12 aid to school districts, foundation program, lists the K through 12 proposed expenditure by the governor's FY 2019 request. Also not exactly part of this bill, but in the fiscal note.
Okay, are there any questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing no questions on the fiscal, sure, a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance is back on record, and Representative Wilson, you've got a comment?
I do. I know you want to move this bill, and I don't want to hold the bill up, but I am truly concerned about going into the principal. And I like the concept that we're going to make more money off of it, but I also know that if we're using the stock market as most of the way that we're going to have the gains and not gains, and if anybody's been watching the market in the last couple of days, it's not been very good. I don't know how to word it so that we don't touch the principal, but yet we also still allow all the rest of this, you know, to happen. And so I don't know, maybe Mr. Painter could address that, but that is really, I think that's what this fund was to do, is to, the division of was that to make sure that we always protected the principal of it, and then we reaped off the excess. So, you know, maybe he could tell me whether my concern is valid or whether or not it wouldn't happen very often, or is there something we could do to make sure that when we get the recommendation from the trustees that somehow we have to follow it?
Mr. Painter, if you could come to the table and put yourself on the record and address the question or comments.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, by removing the distinction between the principal and income, it is possible that then we would dip into what was the principal. It's my understanding of the amendment, adding the up to, we could choose not to do that. But I guess I'm not quite sure what the question is. But yes, you could. The legislature could dip into what the current value of the principal.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any Representative Parrish?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's valuable to observe that Well, this management structure is designed to maintain the inflation-adjusted value of the fund. Having a separate accounts for principal and income doesn't necessarily achieve that objective. And I think over the long term, what's the most real representation of the value of the fund isn't principal income, but rather inflation-adjusted value and being able to maximize the amount available to public education, both this year and in years to come.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Do we have any further questions or comments?
Just to get something on the record.
Representative Gere?
Yeah. Mr. Barnhill, just because I'm not sure the answer to this, but if we go to what you call the prudent expenditure rule? Thanks. Does by allowing you to sort of manage the fund for long-term returns, will this have any impact on the investment strategy that may in the long term lead to better returns, or will that not is that not impacted at all by doing this?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. Yeah, we've sort of covered that. If we shift to endowment methodology, prudent expenditure rule, we will change the asset allocation from a 55-45 equity fixed income allocation to something closer to a 70-30 equity fixed income. Over periods of time, that should generate enhanced growth over a portfolio that's weighted more heavily to fixed income. Over specific periods of time, you know, the equity markets, as you know, are more volatile. So I can't guarantee that it's going to produce more income in any one particular year, but over longer periods of time, it should.
Thanks.
Do we have any further questions or comments? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion. Co-Chair Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 213, version 30, LS0765/R from House Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, HB 213, version 30-LS0765/R, as amended, is reported out from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. And just a reminder, folks could please stay to sign the report. And so our next meeting, if there is nothing else to come for the committee, is scheduled for Friday, February 9th at 1:30 p.m. That's tomorrow. And at this meeting, we will hear SB 6, which is also HB 172, industrial hemp production, and we will be taking public testimony. So with that, we will be adjourned at 2:29 p.m., and if we could sign the report. Thanks, everyone.